Welcome to the Health, Wealth, and Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Hagen, a nutrition coach, entrepreneur, food freedom expert, and forever a recovering disordered eater. I am here to help you own your enoughness, find your very own food freedom, and achieve your health and wellness goals in a way that gives more than it takes. Each week, I will provide you with insight and inspiration surrounding no-nonsense nutrition, mindset, motivation, body image, confidence, and other wellness wisdom. Welcome back to the show. I am here with Coach Lauren, and we are getting ready to record another Q&A podcast episode for you. Hi, Lauren. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. I didn't tell you this before we pressed record, but last night I was doing a little research on the podcast because this past week I heard from at least three people on Instagram that were like, first of all, I think one of them was like, oh my God, you have a podcast. I had no idea. And at first I was like, how did you not know? Do I not talk about it enough? I feel like I talk about it all the time. Regardless. Then I had two other comments that were like, oh my gosh, I love the podcast. Thank you so much. I'm reaching out because you mentioned this in a show or whatever. And so I was like, let me do some deep diving into what our most popular episodes are. Do you want to hear them?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. And if you listening have not listened to these most popular episodes, maybe go back. Or even if you have listened to them, you could probably use a refresher. Our most popular episode. I don't know what happened with this. If someone like sort of famous shared it or what, it has over 2,000 downloads alone, which is insane. Yes. It was episode 252. So like literally we just shared it a couple weeks ago, how to set a weight loss resolution that works.
Hey.
Hey. Yeah. That one must have really hit home for folks because obviously the longer a podcast has been out there, the more listens it acquires, right? So that one brand spanking new, a ton of listens. Another very popular one. This one surprised me. Lower your cholesterol in 5 simple steps. Episode 190 has over 850 downloads.
That's cool though. I like that people are, you know, it's not always just about fat loss, right? We want overall quality of life and overall health. So I think that's a great one to have up there.
Me too.
Like most listened. I like that.
And honestly, it got me thinking maybe we should do like another mini health series. You know, if people are having high blood pressure or, you know, other health circumstances like high fasting glucose or pre-diabetes, anything like that would be so cool, I think. The next one, obviously, number 153, diet-free fat loss, part one.
Love it.
Love it. Yes.
That's our whole message.
Exactly. How we help our clients to achieve healthy and sustainable fat loss without giving up their favorite foods, without worrying that they're going to gain it back, and without having all of these rigid food rules just suck the joy out of their life. Go back and give that one a listen. If you resonate with that and you want to do more work there, you should absolutely fill out a coaching application so we can help you create diet-free fat loss in your life. The fourth most popular episode, I like this one, The Secret to Staying Consistent, episode 142.
You got to stay consistent if you want any results, no matter how sustainable, maintainable the method is. Consistency is still, it's necessary.
Yeah. I think that the fact that that has over 700 downloads just tells me clearly a lot of us struggle with staying consistent. And I would be willing to put money on the fact that it's because we confuse consistency with perfection. So we're expecting ourselves to do something consistently, but we're viewing that, we're defining that as I'm doing this all the time, or I'm doing it as prescribed, when in reality, maybe consistency can even be replaced with more frequently. Like if you're just doing something more often, you are making progress. So I think sometimes that's a little like all or nothing thinking coming in there.
For sure. I used to think that I would like track my consistency. At least I thought I was, but really I was tracking the days I was perfect and the days that I was way off the mark. Cause there was nothing in between ever for me. And it took me like, oh, the in-between days are kind of the most important. Like you're going to be perfect sometimes. You're going to be off the rail occasionally. Most of the time you're going to be in between those two. And consistently means.
Exactly.
It took me way too long to learn that lesson.
Hey, at least you learned it now. I mean,
yes, I did.
We work with women in their 40s, 50s, 60s who still are figuring it out. So it's never too late. The fifth most popular episode, how to make time for yourself and your health as a mom, episode 180.
That's a good one. I mean, it's relatable. Mom, we were just talking about it before we hit record. It's really hard to fit everything in. Working mom, non-working mom, it doesn't matter. Being a mom is all consuming, and it's hard to figure out the balance there.
Hell yeah, it is. It absolutely is. Okay, so those are our top five. And I just found it fascinating to learn what our listeners have been most obsessed with. Like I said, if you have not listened to those or it's been a while, maybe go back and check those out. But today we are answering the questions that you have submitted on social media. If you ever have a Q&A, like something else that you would like answered or addressed in your life when it comes to your progress, all you have to do is reach out. Like, it's literally just an Instagram DM. We are real people. Lauren and I are not cool enough. And I don't even know if cool is the right word. We're not big enough to not answer our own DMs. So like there's no social media manager here. Like, no. I answer every single one of my messages. Lauren answers every single one of her messages. So you're talking to us.
Oh, yes. I think you had it right the first time. I don't know if we're cool enough for that. Nicole, I'm going to be honest. I don't think I am anyway. I'll speak for myself. I am not cool enough to have a social media manager. That sounds like something, I don't know, big fancy influencers do. Like, that's not me. I am a mom who works from home, who does this all on her own with you. So yeah, you'll definitely get an answer directly from myself.
Yes. So please reach out. Like, don't be intimidated. Don't be afraid. We are here to help you. We are navigating our own nutrition as busy working moms. So if we have any insight to share, we are more than happy to do that. And that's what we're going to do in today's show. Are you ready for our first question, Lauren?
Bring it on.
The question is, I recently just found out I have prediabetes. What can I do with my diet to help?
This is going to sound repetitive because the things that you should do for your diet with regards to prediabetes is going to be very similar to the things that we talk about all the time. And that is just going to be your basic nutrition habits. Now, I would say maybe it's a little bit more important to put a little extra effort and attention to these details if you want to prevent going into, you know, having diabetes. But the basics are going to apply here. And so by basics, what I mean is you want to, I'm actually looking at like the American Diabetes Association. They have a recommendation for what a plate is supposed to look like for people with prediabetes or diabetes. And again, it's going to sound really familiar if you've ever listened to our podcast, but you want about half the plate to be non-starchy vegetables, those leafy greens and things like that. And then a quarter of the plate can be what we like to call smart carbs. You do not have to cut carbs. You do not have to avoid carbs. You want to pair the carbs with fiber and protein. So things like whole grains, like rice, quinoa, sweet potatoes, things like that, like starchy vegetables, butternut squash, all kinds of things like that. Fruit can fall under this category. You do not have to fear fruit. But about 25% of your plate can be a good, you know, a portion of healthy carbohydrates with fiber. And then the rest of your plate, the remaining 25% is going to be lean protein, something chicken, turkey, fish, tofu, something like that, that you enjoy. And if you use that template, that'll get you very far. I would even add that you can incorporate healthy fats there too. So maybe things like avocado or cooking your veggies with a little olive oil, sprinkling on some cheese if you, you know, can tolerate dairy, things like that, just to help really round out that balance of the plate. And then in terms of what do we want to minimize? We obviously do want to minimize, but you still don't have to take out. Minimize added sugar. So minimize those typical things that we think of as like the quote bad, which we don't believe in bad foods around here, but the quote bad carbohydrates, things like sugary sodas, cakes, cookies, candies, snacks, all those kind of things. We obviously would want to focus on limiting those types of foods. We also would want to limit any kind of carbohydrates that don't contain fiber. Again, limit does not mean cut out completely, but instead of like a white pasta, maybe you swap it out for a whole wheat pasta. White bread, we swap it out for a whole grain, you know, source, something like that. And then again, in terms of going back to what can we add in, focus on a high fiber intake. So that is going to come from building that balance plate. If you're incorporating healthy carbohydrates, if you're incorporating lots of non-starchy vegetables, if you're incorporating things like fruit, you're going to be good. And you're going to try to hit that goal of 25 to 30 grams of fiber per day. So I always like to say, if you're eating like 5 to 10 grams of fiber right now, definitely increase slowly because your tummy is not going to love a huge increase of fiber out of nowhere. But essentially, like I said, it's just going to go back to the basics that we go on and on and on about. Building balanced meals with all four components, non-starchy vegetables, high fiber carbohydrate, lean protein, dose of healthy fat, limiting those ultra processed foods that contain lots of added sugars, limiting your portions of, you know, refined carbohydrates that aren't containing fiber, and then focusing on adding in 25 to 30 grams of fiber.
Totally agree. Completely. I found it fascinating. I don't know if you know this, Lauren. You probably do. Yesterday, I was listening to a podcast about how nutrition impacts mental health. And the doctor that was on the podcast was mentioning that 1 in 2 people in the United States have prediabetes or diabetes.
I did not know that. That kind of blows me away.
It blew me away so much that I came home. I was listening to this in the car. I quickly got on my computer because I was like, no, that's not the case. That sounds like so many, 50%. So I did some research. Let me tell you that 38% of US adults have prediabetes, many of whom don't even know that they have it. So if you've ever had a fasting blood test done, usually if you go to get your blood drawn and they don't allow you to eat beforehand and you then get your glucose, that's your fasting blood sugar, that is what is assessing your risk for diabetes. And 38% of US adults have prediabetes, which means that that number is usually between 100 and 125. So less than 100 for fasting glucose is ideal in that normal range. But if it's between 100 and 125, technically that is diagnosed as prediabetes. 38% of US adults struggle with prediabetes. 11.6 have diabetes. Do you know what that percentage adds up to when you combine the two? 49.6. So half of us, 1 in 2. Now, there is a genetic component to diabetes, but largely it is classified as a lifestyle disease, which, and of course, we're talking about type 2 diabetes here, which means that through lifestyle interventions, like you mentioned, Lauren, changing our eating habits and our nutrition and our physical activity habits, we can either prevent and or delay our ability or our risk of getting type 2 diabetes if we have prediabetes. So to give those of you listening a little bit of the science, what causes prediabetes, we need to talk about insulin. So insulin is a hormone that's made by our pancreas, and it acts like a key to let blood sugar into our cells. And that's good because we use the blood sugar as energy. If we have prediabetes, the cells in our body don't respond normally to insulin. So our pancreas makes more insulin to try and get the cells to respond. And eventually our pancreas can't keep up, our blood sugar rises, and there we go, setting the stage for prediabetes and type 2 diabetes down the road. So when we're talking about lifestyle interventions, if we have prediabetes, the focus usually, and rightfully so, is on carbohydrates, because carbohydrates have the most significant impact on our blood sugar levels. Because when they're broken down into glucose, that's the sugar that our bodies use for energy, we need to be careful about how much we're taking in and what kind we're taking in if we are already sensitive to insulin, or we're not using insulin correctly or in an ideal way. So controlling our carbohydrate intake, specifically those refined carbs that you mentioned, Lauren, like the white breads, the white pastas, the baked goods, etc., is usually the first step. Instead, swapping those out for complex carbs, or what we call smart fiber-containing carbs, they digest more slowly and then lead to more stable blood sugar levels. So that honestly would be the first thing I would recommend to this person asking the question about prediabetes is, one, what kind of carbs are you eating? Is there an easy opportunity for you to replace your white bread in the morning with a whole wheat slice of toast? Are you snacking on things like pretzels or chips or cookies or potato chips? Could we switch those out for something containing fiber? Even a swap to, say, popcorn, which is a carbohydrate that's really tasty, but also contains more fiber. Could we swap something out like, white rice for a brown rice, or potentially a bean, a lentil, quinoa, a piece of fruit, something that's going to give you more fiber and, again, help your blood sugar to stabilize as opposed to have those extreme spikes and plummets. One thing that I have also anecdotally seen benefit those who struggle with blood sugar issues, be it prediabetes or diabetes, is when you're eating, try to always pair a carbohydrate with a protein, and or a healthy fat or a fiber source, primarily protein or fat. Simply because if we eat a carbohydrate by itself, so let's take breakfast for example, if you just decide to grab a frozen waffle out of the freezer while you're feeding your kids and you munch on that waffle on your way to work, that's pretty much 100% carbohydrate, right? Carbs are fine. They're not evil. But when I am eating just carbohydrate, my body responds, right? It turns into sugar and my blood sugar goes way up. I feel awesome for a hot minute. I've got energy for, you know, 15 minutes, but then I come crashing back down and I had this big spike and now my blood sugar is coming back down, which usually leaves me hangry and groggy and low energy. So then I'm quickly seeking out more food, which is probably not going to be a mindful choice because again, hangry. So I'm going to grab whatever I can find, which is probably another simple carb. And the cycle just repeats, repeats, repeats. My blood sugar ends up being much higher. Then if I started my morning and I really planned to enjoy a waffle with my kids, but I also paired that with scrambled eggs, or I added some Greek yogurt, maybe with some chia seeds on top and fruit or something like that. Are you still eating the carbohydrate? Yes, absolutely. But now you're adding the protein, depending on whether you're using whole eggs or what type of fat content is in your Greek yogurt. You've got a good source of healthy fat there. Now your blood sugar is going to increase because that's what happens when we eat. That's normal. So we don't want to be freaking out unnecessarily about blood sugar increases, but it's not going to increase as high and it is going to stabilize and give me longer lasting energy. So I don't have that crash where I'm then seeking out like brownies in the break room, for example. I hope that that's a helpful explanation. Did I miss anything there, Lauren?
No, I don't think you did. And I want to emphasize the fact that blood sugar spikes after we eat are normal. I was going to say that because it's a trend right now, right? Everybody's wearing those CGMs, the continuous glucose monitors, which the average person does. Your body, you're going to have an increased blood sugar response to a meal. You can do things like we've been saying, like pairing them with healthy fats and lean proteins and high fiber foods to minimize those spikes. We don't want the dramatic spikes and the dramatic, you know, drops. That's not what we're going for. But there is going to be a spike after you eat. That's a good thing. That's your body reacting to food, right? We want that to happen. So don't freak out about that. If you're wearing one of those, expect that that's going to happen. That does not mean you have to completely eliminate carbohydrates to avoid any and all increases in your blood sugar. But to minimize those spikes, to make them a little bit more even, to have slower digestion, which gives us better energy throughout the day, yes, pair them with a protein, pair them with fiber, pair them with a healthy fat. And I like that you encourage people, like, just start by swapping out some carbs if you can. Or, you know, just, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It doesn't have to be all at once. Just one little swap. What simple carbs are you eating right now that you can swap out for a more fiber-containing carb? Start there and then work your way up through the list, right? Can you add some fiber? Can you add some healthy fat? Things like that.
Obviously, as nutrition coaches, we're focusing on the nutrition component. And absolutely, I would recommend anyone start there because nutrition is so powerful. Also, something simple though that just popped into my brain that has been shown to reduce blood sugar is going for a walk after you eat. Because exercise obviously requires us to pull sugar from the body as energy, right? So then we're not keeping that in our body for our body to use or store. So then our blood sugar is lower over time. So if after you eat, you feel like, yeah, I could totally crash on the couch and binge watch my favorite show, but you know what? It's not that outside of the realm of possibility for me to walk around the block and do 10, 15 minutes, take the dog, take the kids, whatever. That also is something that is seemingly simple, right? You don't need anything fancy to do it. Throw on some sneakers. Just go for a walk after a meal. Yeah.
10 minutes. If you're in an office, see if you can like go up and down the stairs or something like that. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be this formal big walk. I think that's what people get adding in walks throughout the day. They think it has to be a certain time or look a, like quote count. Literally, just get up from your desk and walk around your office for 10 minutes. You're still moving.
When I worked for our local health system, I would literally on my breaks take my phone. Usually I would be listening to a podcast episode. Sometimes I would be like messaging people back on like voice notes, and I would just walk in circles around a conference room. I probably looked ridiculous to anyone looking in the room, but it was empty. Nobody else was in there. And it was the way that I could get steps if the weather was gross outside. Don't be afraid to look silly. Get your steps. No.
Actually, the gym nurse, if anybody follows her, she talks about how she walks while she's waiting in pickup line for her kids. And I think about that a lot because I personally would feel a little silly doing it, but I love that she's just like, yeah, I'm sure if my daughters knew I did this, they'd be mortified, but it's sitting in this line for this long, I can get up and walk for 15 minutes instead of just sitting in my car. So yeah, doesn't have to look a certain way. Walk around a table in a conference room, walk when you're picking up your kids, just get up and move a little bit.
All of these things will absolutely help you to manage your blood sugar, which also means feeling better. By the way, when we are having blood sugar that's wonky and all over the place, our energy is wonky and all over the place. Sometimes we get those crashes and we're lightheaded. And yes, obviously having prediabetes or type 2 diabetes can cause some complications down the line, but also just quality of life. So if you're struggling with high blood sugar, maybe give some of these things a try.
There might be like a chicken and the egg effect, because if I'm eating a simple carbohydrate, kind of like you mentioned, and then I have that big crash, the next thing that I want is another simple carbohydrate because my body is just so freaking out and looking for energy. And we know those give us that quick energy. So it's definitely like a snowball effect where like one good decision can make the next one a little bit easier. And then it just keeps getting easier because you're feeling a little bit better and you're just in more, you just have a little bit more control over your food choices when you're not in that, like, I have zero energy, give me all the donuts type of a headspace.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Actually, this is reminding me of yesterday, maybe the day before, I don't know, sometime this week, I was just wanting something crunchy, salty, and I hadn't eaten lunch yet. So I got up from my desk and I was like, you know what? I could really go for in my pantry right now. I have, is it Hippies? Those chickpea crisps?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that's actually how you pronounce the brand name, but I tried those for the first time and I was like, you know what? I could just eat those. Like that sounds good to me right now. But then I asked myself, if I go ahead and sit down and eat this, am I really then going to want to sit down to my plate with protein and vegetables afterwards? Of course not. If I had that carb, which is mostly a simple carb, chickpeas, I guess we could call, you know, there's some fiber there. So I'm getting maybe a complex carb, but it's a packaged processed carbohydrate that is mostly giving me pleasure and not a ton of nutrients. If I ate that first, hands down, I would just want to eat another simple carb. Like, give me something else that's crunchy and delicious. I don't then want to go and sit down and have my Brussels sprouts and my salmon, you know, or like my salad with my turkey breast on top. So I committed to having the protein and the veggies first. And then I ate the chickpea crisps and it was delicious and I got what I wanted. But it's a perfect example of what you just said, where if we only have that carb, then our palate is trained to want more hyperpalatable food. And we're then unlikely to be like, you know what? Let me sit down and eat something really nourishing. Yeah. We're probably just going to keep snacking.
Yeah, I heard this and I don't think it needs to be followed 100% of the time. But as a general rule, nourish first, satisfy second. Like in your example, eat the salmon and veggies first, then eat the kind of fun little snack second. And you'll just probably have a little bit more easier time controlling the urge to polish off that bag of fun little treats.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Next question. I feel like I can't even be successful with the smallest change. Eating healthy and losing weight feels impossible. So this isn't a question per se, but I think we understand what the author is asking. How the heck do they set about wanting to eat healthy and lose weight? It sounds like this person has those goals when even making the tiniest health promoting adjustment feels insurmountable.
So the first thing that comes into my head when I hear this statement is, I say this a lot, the story we tell ourselves is very, very powerful. If you are, and this is not to shame, this is to bring awareness. This is like, if I'm sitting around telling myself, I can't do this, it's too hard, I'll never be successful, then yeah, I probably won't ever be successful because I have this very fixed mindset around creating change. I've decided before I've even really given it a try that I won't be successful, versus a growth mindset of, I'm not there yet. This is feeling really hard for me right now, but I know in the future, if I keep with it, it'll get a little bit easier. And you can take this as slow as you want. You can literally, it can mean eating 2 bites of a vegetable a day. I don't care what the tiny little habit that you're going to incorporate is. But to me, this statement is less about getting in those habits and more about just having that growth mindset and believing that you're capable of doing it, instead of starting off the day with, ugh, I can't do this, it's too hard, I'm not going to do it today, I'll start tomorrow, or whatever, or I'm just not capable, or it's too hard for me, it's easier for everybody else type thinking. I think the main thing I would tell this person is, I would really question, why do you believe that? Like, where are those thoughts coming from? How can we reframe them to tell a different story? And then, yes, pick a tiny little habit. Again, I don't care how small it is, but let's start there and then really build up on some wins to give you that confidence of, oh, I told myself I was going to walk for 5 minutes and I did that 3 days last week. That's great. That's a win. I told myself that I was going to set out my gym clothes, not even go to the gym, set out my gym clothes the night before. And I did that. That's fantastic. Now the next step is maybe putting them on and doing a 5 minute, you know, jumping jack routine in your room. I don't care. Again, it does not matter how tiny it is. It is just having more of a growth mindset around it. Being very careful with the story that you're telling yourself about your capabilities. And then, yes, choosing some, you know, I would not recommend that this person overhauls their entire life. You know, it sounds like that would be very overwhelming to them. So then I would start with some very realistic small steps and really celebrate the hell out of each and every win. Because each time you follow through with those promises, those commitments that you made, you're just building up that belief in yourself that you can do it. And that is actually a really important part of the process. You have to believe that you can do it before you do it. If you go into it assuming you can't do it, then that's going to be the pattern. You'll try, you'll fail, and then you'll be like, see, I knew it. I knew I couldn't do it. So to me, this is more of a mindset issue than maybe a, you know, ability issue. Because I do think everybody has the ability to create these changes. It's whether or not you believe that you can do it, whether or not you create the time to do it and then set yourself up for success with the proper steps, the proper action steps for each individual.
I completely agree with everything you just said. Obviously, we want to make sure that we aren't dealing with any physical barriers that need addressed first also. So what I would ask this person is, what do you think is standing in your way of being successful, even with the smallest thing? So maybe they feel as though they can't even walk for 5 minutes a day, or they're not being successful with that. What is the barrier that they're facing? I have worked with many clients who have been navigating debilitating depression while trying to create health promoting change. And we realized they need a med change. Their brain needs a little extra help. And so the tiniest thing does feel insurmountable. We've talked about spoon theory on this podcast before, where you and I, Lauren, are waking up with 12 spoons to utilize and, you know, apply throughout the day. And if we go to the gym and get our workout in, that takes one spoon. And if we decide to eat a healthy, well-balanced meal instead of snacking on the chips in the pantry, that's another spoon. And we utilize our spoons throughout the course of the day. But for someone who has severe anxiety, debilitating depression, you know, some other type of mental illness, they may wake up with only 7 spoons to use instead of 12, because simply getting out of bed took 5 spoons, you know? So we're not all working with the same mental capacity. And so I think we do have to address physical barriers. Is there something that needs addressed here, which is causing me to feel like I can't be successful? I think the mindset is a huge component. And to what you said, I would also ask that person to define what they view success as, because if success means doing something every day, well, I don't think I've been successful with anything I've tried in my entire life, right? So if you're expecting yourself to like do something every day for a period of time and you feel like, oh, I can't even be successful with this, even if it's something small, if your definition of success is doing it perfectly or without ever having a day off, no, you can't be successful, but neither can anybody, right? Like we have to redefine success to make it realistic and human. We are going to mess up. We're going to miss days. That doesn't mean that you can't be successful at something. So I think that that is where I would start with this person. But you are right. If we have a fixed mindset where we believe our ability is a static, stagnant thing, I can't do this, I will never be able to do this, then we're right. We won't. Research shows that self-efficacy, the belief that we have in our ability to control our future, plays the biggest role in creating change. And we have to have that growth mindset. What I also have found anecdotally in the lives of, well, my life and the lives of my clients, is that when I'm dealing with this situation, I feel like I'm struggling to be successful, even with the tiniest thing, the most damaging barrier is comparison. So the person who is struggling and feeling like this, I'm pointing to my question on my pages, if you can see me, but the person who is struggling with feeling like they can't even be successful with the tiniest thing is probably watching social media and seeing that they should completely overhaul their diet by going keto. Or maybe their best friend just posted online about how she did X, Y, and Z and is crushing it. Now, keep in mind, that's a highlight reel, right? That's not everything about that person's experience or their life. You have no idea what's actually going on behind the scenes. But maybe that works for them. I don't know, but it's clearly not working for you. And so I think if you are struggling yourself to navigate even a tiny change, one of the worst things that you can do is kind of put yourself in a position where you are watching other people who are seemingly doing it better or doing more complex things and succeeding. I think that it's just going to keep us in that sucky, stuck place. Comparison is so triggering when you're in this situation.
I totally agree. And I think comparison leads to self-shame, which we know is like the worst motivator of all time. Shame does not work. And if we are just sitting there watching other people's highlight reel, you know, feel bad because somebody else is eating in a way that we want to, but just aren't, that shame actually keeps us stuck. Like it makes us feel hopeless. I think there has to be some kind of a hope there of no, I can do this. It doesn't have to look like that. It can look like however it needs to look for me in my life. And I'm glad you brought up that point because I think it's an important one to make. It can look however it needs to look for you. This is a personal journey. That is why I think coaching is so helpful because it breaks it down for each individual. There isn't a like, here's this list of steps. Now go complete them. You'll be saved. Okay. Starting from, and how much do we have to break this down to get you to your eventual end goal? Because it has to be individualized like that. It's essential to success.
Okay. So I feel like we shared so much value there, but it's not concise. So I'm going to try to summarize what we just said into a couple of very tangible takeaways. If you feel like you're struggling with creating even the smallest change, and maybe you're finding that your weight loss journey or healthy eating journey feels impossible, remember to set achievable goals. So you have to be making realistic goals for yourself. If the expectation is to do something perfectly, you're going to run into a lot of friction there. To start with something that feels so manageable. So like Lauren mentioned, a 5-minute walk or setting your gym clothes out. I remember when I was an intern with Precision Nutrition, an online nutrition coaching company, they had all of their clients start with 2 weeks of simply taking a multivitamin. They don't do this anymore. It was either a multivitamin or fish oil. I forget. But either way, they just had everybody start taking this supplement. That was it. That was it. Because they just wanted to build the confidence in their clients that they could do this one thing. That is the thing. You're going to start your day with a win. You're going to do that consistently over the next 2 weeks. We're not even going to talk about anything else until you do that. So just another example of doing something teeny tiny to kind of build confidence. 3, practice self-compassion. So you're going to mess up. Setbacks are a normal part of the process, but if you're super self-critical, you're going to have a really hard time picking yourself back up and continuing to move on. You have to treat yourself with the same love and kindness that you would offer a friend facing a similar challenge. 4, explore your barriers, because there may be like a legitimate obstacle. Maybe you're struggling with something, you know, mental illness. Maybe there is a physical limitation that you need help overcoming. Let's talk through that, which brings us to point number 5, which is to seek support and maybe hire some professional help, because there is nothing more daunting than trying to navigate creating change on your own when you feel like you're stuck in your own headspace. And whether it's a coach or a mentor or a therapist can be invaluable. Helps you to work through the barriers, overcome the obstacles, and create the change that you want to create in less time with less frustration.
Beautifully said, beautifully summarized.
Thanks, Lauren. Okay, 3rd and final question for today. My doctor told me what my goal weight should be, and it sounds really low. How do I know what my goal weight should be?
Ugh, this one, I feel like this is a tricky question with a lot of nuance to it and a lot of it depends, because it does depend. I know people still use BMI, and I'm not like as anti-BMI as a lot of people are. I think it certainly has its place with the average person. To me, a healthy weight though, I actually just did a post on this the other day, is the weight that you can relatively easily maintain, right? I say relatively easy because I do think it always requires some effort, right? It's a lot of times it's easy to want to go through the drive-thru or whatever, not skip the meal prep. So there's always an effort required a little bit, but relatively easily maintain your weight by prioritizing nutrient-dense foods, by getting enough sleep, by managing your stress, by moving your body in a way that feels good. And then I always say bonus points if it includes strength training, because that is actually extremely important to our quality of life. And still get to live your life. And you still get, enjoy holidays, enjoy birthday dinners, enjoy like fun meals out, things like that. But the majority of the time you're prioritizing those nutrient dense foods without necessarily having to count, track, all that kind of stuff. It feels a little bit effortless. So to me, whatever weight your body kind of settles on by doing those things is probably a comfortable, ideal weight for you, because you are prioritizing your health. You're living all of those quality, healthy habits and, in a realistic way. Now, if you're doing all of those things and you feel like, hey, I still want to, live in a leaner body, I don't think there's anything wrong with that either. And then we can take some steps to, get you in a deficit from all of those things. But I think if you don't have the healthy habits in place, you're never going to reach your comfortable, happy, ideal weight. That comes first. They're kind of like, they work together, I guess. I don't feel like I said that well. Can you speak to that in a much clearer way than what I just said?
I think what you said makes sense to me. So actually this was a client experience, and I just had this coaching call earlier this week, and the client had a doctor's appointment, and she came to me and she said, so my doctor told me that I should weigh X, like X is my goal weight. And I bit my tongue and I said, well, how did you feel when your doctor told you that? And she said, honestly, it sounds really low. And my second question was, did your doctor ask you about your nutrition habits and what your diet looks like? And she said, no, she didn't ask me at all what my nutrition looked like. That's a red flag for me. First of all, if your doctor isn't asking you about the habits that you currently have and whether they're healthy, or maybe there are some things that you want to change and could change, maybe they shouldn't just be prescribing goal weights to you, because obviously healthy doesn't look like one size. And what most of the medical field is using when they are computing a goal weight is BMI. Now, like you said, Lauren, BMI, the body mass index, is one method that we can use to calculate what is often referred to as, quote, an ideal weight. And what it does is we take your weight in kilograms and we divide it by the square of your height in meters. So it's a little complex, but you can find an online calculator. You can easily do it. And generally a BMI between 18.5 and 24.9 is considered healthy. Now, while I think BMI can be used when we're looking at like the population at large, especially a population that isn't physically active and that doesn't strength train or exercise consistently, I think there could be benefit to using this as kind of like an overarching tool. But BMI fails because it doesn't account for individual differences. It doesn't account for muscle mass or body composition, right? Like how much of your body is muscle or fat or water or tissue. There's none of that, which obviously makes a big difference in health. Right? So I prefer, and this is a little harder to use, the medical field does not use this, but I prefer to use body fat percentage. It's another approach where we can focus on how much of your body is fat compared to those other things like muscle and tissue and water. This provides a much more accurate measure of overall health and fitness, but it's more difficult to assess. So we can use methods like a bioelectrical impedance analysis. So sometimes you can like hold on to a little tool. I've used this working in fitness studios and gyms. You can use skin fold calipers, which are kind of a thing of the past. I don't know anyone that does that anymore, or like a DEXA scan to measure your body fat percentage. There are scales that will read it to you, like bathroom scales, but they're not completely accurate. I always tell clients, if you have a bathroom scale that's reading you your body fat percentage, don't put any stock in like that one number, but we still should be able to assess trends over time. So is that body fat percentage increasing or is it decreasing? That's another way to go about it. Honestly, I think what's going to work best for most of us in terms of a goal weight, if we want to call it that, is looking at exactly what you said. What are our healthy habits comprised of that we feel like we can sustain long-term and that give us the outcomes we desire and know are going to benefit our long-term health. So what do our blood panels say? Are we healthy? Like, is our blood sugar and our cholesterol and our blood pressure telling us that like things are good? You're taking care of yourself. Or are those health markers maybe popping up some red flags, some concerns that maybe would cause some complications for our long-term health and well-being? Can I comfortably walk up a set of stairs, bend over and tie my shoes? Like, am I feeling like I can live the life I want to live? Or am I struggling with my quality of life on a day-to-day basis? Like, these are the things that I think matter most. And I don't care whether that's, you know, that puts you at 100 and some odd pounds or 200 and some odd pounds, but are you feeling like that's healthy for you? Do you feel like it's a weight you can maintain while also knowing that the actions you're taking to achieve that weight are healthy? So I think that that's what you were saying is kind of that third point of like, you have to be able to navigate it for a very long time if you want that to be a weight that you can sustain. You have to be able to navigate the behaviors pretty confidently.
Well, and weight is just one point of our health. I'm not saying it's not an important one. It is. But it's just also, you're kind of zooming in on one piece of the puzzle and not looking at anything else. Like you mentioned, like your blood work, what is that looking like? What are your health markers looking like? Are they in the right ranges? Then great. And this client, I'm sure, could achieve that lower body weight, but could she do it with healthy, you know, actions? If not, you know, if she has to dramatically undereat or really increase her physical activity and burn herself out and have crappy energy and lose her period and all those things, like, then so she reached the weight, but is that a healthy weight for her at that point? No. So there's so much more than just your weight. Our health is comprised of so much more, both our physical health and our mental health. When I say health, I really mean all of it, all of it, because it all works together and you can't just look at weight as the end all be all. If you are healthy, this is the weight you should be. And also specific goal rates. I mean, goal weights should be a range, in my opinion, too, because maintenance is a range. I mean, I would, you know, you are allowed to have some flexibility there. If you're only caring about hitting, you know, this very specific number, what happens if you're a pound away? Does that mean that you failed or that you're unhealthy because you're a pound higher than what the doctor said? Of course not. So I just think it's a very simplistic, like microscopic way to look at health is being like, here's your goal weight, now go. There's mm-hmm. so much more that goes into our health than what the scale says. And again, I'm not anti the scale. I think health, our weight is important part of our health, but it's not the only thing that we need to be looking at.
I think in this situation, I'm not speaking for every situation, goal weights, I understand, can be motivating for some individuals. They do give you a form of measurement. So you can celebrate your progress as you inch closer to it. It does provide a source of accountability. You can have all of those things, momentum, and you know, you can find some motivation. You can set measurable goals. You can have accountability without having a goal weight. I think in this particular situation, a physician saying you need to hit this exact number in order to, you know, be healthy was more detrimental than beneficial. I wish the doctor hadn't done that. And so what I told this client was, you know what? We may find that you feel best 10 pounds heavier than that, 15 mm-hmm. pounds heavier than that. And that's okay. We may find that you feel best 10 pounds lighter than that, or we may find that you feel best somewhere around that range. We have no idea. All I ask is that we set this number on the back burner. It means nothing. It's just a calculation. That's all. And we focus on the trend of your progress over time and how you feel as we start to approach a place that feels very good and healthy and maintainable for you. And that's not going to be one number for the rest of your life, right? It is going to be a range, like you said, but only how we feel in that moment and in our bodies, given the habits that we're making on a regular basis, can tell us what a healthy, maintainable, happy weight is for us. And there's not one goal weight that I would encourage anyone to have simply because it trains our brain to say anything less than this number. And what I mean by that is anything more than this number, right? Like anything other than this number means I'm not good enough. I'm not successful. I haven't reached the goal. When in reality, you could be completely transformed. You could have a completely different relationship with food. You could have a completely different body composition. You could have a completely transformed health status and health outcomes, but maybe you're not that number. Does that mean that you haven't reached the goal? Does that mean that you haven't made progress? Absolutely not.
Yeah, it just doesn't take in. I'm just sitting here thinking too now. I'm like, so does that mean everybody who, like, I'm, you know, in my late 30s, I guess I should say, I'm 37 now. but every woman around my age who's 5'5", should we all weigh exactly the same? Because I have weighed a lot less and definitely feel healthier now because I have a lot more muscle mass in my body. So yeah, I have an extra 15 pounds on my body, but I feel better. So is that, you know, it's just, it doesn't take into account for so many individual differences that we really need to think about and factor in.
Yeah. I think it's just, it's an archaic way of viewing health, mm-hmm. which is the number on the scale. And what we know is that health and weight are not the same thing. And health can look like many different shapes, sizes, and weights. And anyone who tells you otherwise is misinformed. And I believe doesn't have a diverse or inclusive perspective of health, which extends far beyond how big or how much density your body has.
Yes, 1,000%. Totally agree.
We got there. We got there. Yeah.
We did it.
All right, squad. If you have a question that you would like to hear us stumble over answering, we're happy to be here for you. Like, I can't express this enough. Lauren and I are in the trenches with you. I actually just got a question from a client asking me to, this is the podcast I was referencing earlier, listen to this podcast. It's a long one, over like an hour and a half, talking about how following a ketogenic diet could potentially reverse mental illness. And she listened to this podcast, and it was by a pretty, like, it was on a pretty renowned podcast. And she's like, I'm curious. I also have reservations. I would really appreciate it if you could listen to this, dive into the research with me, and let me know if there's any truth to this. Like, is this something worth putting time and energy into? And I said, absolutely. Give me the week. I'm going to kind of dive deep into this episode. I've finished it yesterday. Now I'm looking into the research, looking into the doctor that was interviewed. I'm happy to do this research with you. First of all, I geek out over it every single time. If there's something with regards to nutrition and health and wellness and mindset that I feel like benefits you or I, let's talk about it. And so I told her I would circle back around with, you know, what the evidence says and whether there's credibility to his claims. So if you have a question that you're curious about, let's dive into it together. All we can do is try to make the most sense out of a world that's filled with misinformation and quick fixes and try to figure out, like, what is actually worth our time.
Yeah. I think I know who you're talking about, the doctor, but I can't remember his name. But yeah, we'll talk about it later.
We'll talk about it later because
yeah,
I'm really, really interested in, like, yeah. I mean, I was listening to, we don't have to get into it right now. Let's not get into it right now. I could go off.
I think I know who you're talking about. I just can't, his name isn't coming to me.
Circle back. We will address mental health and nutrition in an upcoming podcast episode. If you haven't already, please do us a huge favor and rate and review the show. Especially written reviews mean the world. So other people can't find the show unless the podcast algorithm says, oh, hey, people are loving this. People are liking it. People are actually taking time out of their day and leaving reviews. Please, 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 30 seconds, leave a 5-star review and let us know if you are liking what you're listening to.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Health, Wealth, and Wisdom Podcast. If you like what you heard today, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe, and then head on over to nutritioncoachingwithnicole.com where you can sign up for my weekly emails where I send out my favorite tips, tricks, advice, and support every single Monday morning to help you kick your week off right. Thanks for listening. Until next time.